Hey, this is Texas country musician Bree Bagwell inviting you to check out my podcast, Only Vans. Listen, love it, and subscribe now on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network or wherever you get your podcasts. It's where I come to you from my backyard in my van. Well, actually, we upgraded to an RV, but it still has the front end of a van, so it still counts. So basically, I get all my friends and we sit right here with my dog. This is Whiskey. And we talk about important things like feet pictures, getting told you look tired, dating in the music scene. Listen, love it, and subscribe now on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, and welcome to Basic Folk, where we have honest conversations with folk musicians on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network. It's me, Cindy House. I host this podcast. Thanks for finding us. Hope you're doing all right. And I'm very happy to be welcoming Missy Raines to the podcast today. The lady, the legend. Before we get into Missy Raines, let's talk about us. How can we stay in touch with each other? It's important to stay in touch with your loved ones. The best way to do it for Basic Folk is to sign up for our monthly newsletter that you can do at the link in the show notes, or you can go to basicfolk.com, sign up for it there. It tells you what's going on with the podcast and what's going on inside our little folky hearts. Isn't that nice? You can also follow us on social media. We are on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok. At Basic Folk Pod. Find us there. If you are ready to take your relationship with Basic Folk to the next level, you can become a monthly contributor or a one-time contributor by going to the link in the show notes. Basicfolk.com/donate is where you can make a monthly contribution or a one-time gift. Really helps us out in being able to do everything that we do. It's a lot of work to put this podcast together. You know, we have people working behind the scenes and the backgrounds, and we like to pay them. With your help, we can do that so we don't go broke while we try to make this folk podcast. All right. Acclaimed bluegrass musician Missy Raines is also a very cool and funny lady. Originally from West Virginia, not far from the Maryland border and the city of Cumberland. First of all, I had questions for her about why people from West Virginia are so into their state. She gets into that and also the influence and the rich tapestry of bluegrass music she found there, as well as the scene in nearby Washington, D.C. Raines has made a significant impact on the genre, earning 14 International Bluegrass Music Association awards, including 10 for Bass Player of the Year. Wow. Her latest album, Highlander, showcases Raines' mastery of the bass alongside an ensemble of top-tier musicians from Nashville, which has been her home base for the last 34 years, and beyond, blending traditional bluegrass music with innovative twists. Throughout our conversation, Raines reflects on her deep connection to Appalachian culture and the Appalachian Mountains, which have profoundly influenced her music. We explore her experience performing live at music festivals and the evolution of bluegrass music. We recount the passion her family felt for music, touching on the story of her mom and aunt crying their eyes out over John Duffy leaving their favorite bluegrass band, the Kentucky Gentlemen. She also talks about taking care of her late brother, Rick, who died in 1994 from AIDS at the age of 39. Through that experience, she was empowered to help others whose loved ones were also dying and suffering from HIV and AIDS. With her unique blend of banjo and fiddle music and her activism in a normally conservative genre, Raines continues to push the boundaries of the genre while staying true to its roots, making her a trailblazer in the world of Americana and folk music. Our conversation was in-depth, fun, and enlightening. I had high hopes for this one, and I'll tell you what, dear listener, I was not disappointed. Let's take a listen to a song from her new album, Highlander. Let's hear Ghost of a Love, and then we'll get into our conversation with Missy Raines on Basic Folk.
Ghost
Missy Raines, thanks for coming on Basic Folk.
Thank you so much for having me. This is a great pleasure.
Okay, I have some pretty long setups for some of these questions, including this first one that we're going to start with. So you are originally from Short Gap, West Virginia, which West Virginia is a very big state. Short Gap is in the northern part of the state, just across the Potomac River from Cumberland, Maryland, which was the town where your family, like, did everything in. Your dad went to work there. You went to church there. Also, you were not far from DC, which is where your family started, like, hitting up festivals and concerts. Your parents were big live music fans, country and bluegrass, you know, to be sure. There were some jams at your house. Sounds pretty exciting, like an idyllic childhood filled with listening to music and playing music. So it sounds like very, like, my family grew up, we were in suburban Boston, and we were in the 4-H club, and nobody else was in the 4-H club. So it was kind of strange. So I was thinking of that through this, I was thinking of, like, through this lens, like, how did your family relate to other families when you were growing up?
Well, I too was in 4-H, loved 4-H.
Oh, hey, hey, what was your project?
Oh, well, I was at the time, I guess I was in home ec kinds of things. Mm, yeah.
Okay.
I didn't stay in past about the age of 11 or something because music.
Okay. Of course. Yeah. All consuming. It's all consuming.
It kind of really was. But how did we relate to everyone else? I mean, in where I was in rural West Virginia, just outside of Maryland, I mean, in a lot of ways, like, things like 4-H definitely were relatable. I mean, that's what sort of, like, everyone was doing. I often get that people say, oh, you must have had bluegrass coming out of your ears being where you were. And yes, there were a lot of people who played old-time country and bluegrass and old-time music around there. But I have to say, I was exposed to a whole lot more when we traveled down into the DC area. And it was really just due east, but it was down out of the mountains. So how I related, I didn't relate well because honestly, kids my age at the time, they didn't know what bluegrass was. They were going by the stereotypes that were pretty prevalent of the day, and they were not good stereotypes. And so, mm-hmm. I mean, this was just after, you know, Bonnie and Clyde had been out as a movie in Deliverance. I mean, so
yes,
this is all before, you know, things like the Oh Brother movie and things like that made it, like, super cool. You know, so it wasn't super cool yet. And mm-hmm. so I found it very unrelatable for most of my childhood, which is why I was driven to I asked my folks if I could just play with everybody that I could, which meant often, well, just playing in with every band I could my entire high school years, all 4 years of my high school time, I spent the weekends playing with older people in bars I wasn't old enough to be in. And I didn't go to any football games, or I didn't do any dances or anything like that.
Right. It's so funny to, like, get out of high school and then you're like, wait, there are all these parties going on while I was playing my bass or showing my sheep at the county fair.
Yeah. I mean, I loved those ideas and the ideal of that kind of rural life. I mean, which I still love. The party aspect of it, I was, you know, but I felt like I was partying, but it was always at a bluegrass festival, and it was with people who were, and we were partying and talking about Tony Rice.
That's so cool. Okay, this is a question about the love of West Virginia. I'm from Massachusetts, which is like not a state that people are like overly proud of like being from. I just moved to Maine, which I think is a lot like West Virginia, which I lived near West Virginia for a really long time in Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. People are obsessed with West Virginia. Like the marketing is also really good. Wild and wonderful, and like all these beautiful fonts and pictures of mountains, etc. So, like, what is your observation of that like phenomenon of like being so obsessed with West Virginia? And then, what has been your experience with that super strong state pride?
Yeah, I love this question because I find it also equally fascinating. I mean, I am exactly what you're talking about, but I guess I've spent enough time away that I sort of look back and I see and I know how my family is. You know, I know that if anyone says anything about the Mountaineers, I mean, they're fierce. You know, they're just going to be ready to just to go down. You know, like just
right. They'll lay down their life.
Oh yeah,
and for West Virginia.
And it's, you know, I don't know exactly why. But on the other hand, I could, you know, theorize a lot of things because of just thinking about the history of the state, knowing just the geography alone is challenging. The entire state.
Every highway.
Every highway.
You get car sick.
Every road. It's the only state in the entire country that's within the Appalachian Mountains. So there's no flat area. There's no straightaway. And the weather is, you know, can be like the kind of weather you have in that kind of elevation and all that. I think that from the beginning, people started, you know, when they started moving there and trying to make a living is hard because it's hard to be self-sustaining, meaning that, you know, the idea of like a big farm where you're actually like making enough food to sell to other people, that's just kind of crazy because you just make, if you can farm enough land that's flat enough that you can actually farm it to sustain and to provide for your own family, that's success. And so there's things that I think that there's this ideal that people get where they just feel like we are hardy because we have survived living here for all these years. We are hardy. We know how to take care of ourselves. We will help our neighbors if they need them. If they need the help, we are there. But otherwise, we are just going to be as strong as we can, and we're going to, you know, take care of what we need to take care of our families. And you know, there's a lot of rich minerals and rich things within the ground in that state. So a lot of people, people have come in and, you know, tried to market all that stuff. But again, the people that are there feel like that just being there, just getting through and surviving and actually more than surviving, but, you know, flourishing is a pretty great thing. And we're proud of that.
Your mom and dad were pretty awesome music fans, like dreamboats. They went to the shows. They wanted to sit right up front. I heard you tell the story of your mom and your aunt like crying their eyes out when it was a John Duffy left the Country Gentleman. Like,
yes,
they were serious fans. Yeah.
I thought someone had died when I heard my aunt and my mom crying in the living room. And my cousins had come. They'd all come unexpectedly and for a visit. We all came upstairs from playing outside, and I heard them crying in the living room. And I was like, "What happened?" And my cousin said, "Didn't you know?" And
obviously,
and I said, "No, what?" And she said, "John Duffy has left the Country Gentleman," and then my mother and my aunt are in there weeping and playing Country Gentleman records at this huge loud volume.
It just makes such an impression. It must have made such an impression on you, like the reverence that they felt for this music. So how do you think that their like appreciation and respect has impacted the way like you are as a fan?
Oh, I think it's totally affected how I feel about the music. And because I knew that it was so important especially my mom. My mom, you know, she suffered from depression a lot, so music was a great healer for her. Mm-hmm. And I think that I remember, you know, when I would come home from school and when I'd walk in that house and if I heard the stereo playing bluegrass, I knew that she felt good. And I that connected with me a lot. It just how healing music can be. The loyalty that they both had, my parents had for bluegrass particularly, but for so many of those early performers. Yeah, it's embedded in me. I can't help to have been affected by that. And I probably hold a lot of that stuff. It's nostalgic for me, but it's also very real.
Mm. It sounds like almost like religious.
You know, that is so powerful that you said that to me, because actually it was like that for my mom. And my dad was a super easygoing, and he was just kind of like he and my mom were just really, really cute together. And so she kind of drove a lot of this. So, but I will say that my mom she wasn't super religious, but she did. She was one of the only kids in her family to have been baptized when she was a baby as a Catholic, because they thought she was going to die. It was during the Depression, and there was something that happened, and she obviously didn't. But my great grandmother insisted that she be baptized, and so I was raised early on as Catholic, and but I say this because she believed in the religion, but not always the people. So she was very great about just like if when things came along that she thought just weren't right, then she was very quick to say so. But also, when we started going less to church, which would have coincided exactly around the time that we started going to a lot of bluegrass festivals. And I remember my mom, I remember me as like a young kid saying, you know, you know, kind of questioning this a little bit, like, are we going to be missed or whatever? And my mom, you know, at one point she just sort of said, God is definitely at bluegrass festivals. she wasn't being it to her. It wasn't a joke. It was just like she believed that we were doing something as a family that was good and that was important. And and she believed that God was everywhere. So, it really was kind of like a religion for her.
I really like your mom.
Yeah, she was
like, she was wonderful.
She was very wonderful and very ahead of her time in a lot of ways.
So that live concert experience, like you grew up going to live shows, like you can't remember the first music festival that you went to. So especially since you went on to play music live professionally, like you must feel all sorts of ways about the emotions and feelings that come about like when you're in a live music setting. Like how has that evolved for you, the way that you feel when you're at a live concert?
Well, I don't remember yet. Yeah, I don't remember the very first festival. But I do remember being very, very young and it being like the Saturday night show outside. And I think, again, my mom created this sense, much like she did for a holiday like Christmas, where she created this, anticipation for the event that made it magical. And she also like the evening show of a bluegrass festival was very magical because that's when like maybe the headliners were going to play. And she wanted to make sure we were fed and then we were dressed warmly so that we could all go down to the stage and watch this thing. And she made it very special. And so what I remember is having that anticipation sort of built into me as a kid and then going and being down there and hearing, you know, the Osborne brothers and Bill Monroe and all those guys, and hearing their voices and being in this crowd outside, but with lights and in the trees and in some of the locations, there might be a river nearby, particularly Berryville, Virginia. And, just being in that company of all these people feeling sick, but also feeling completely safe and all of those things. So when I hear to this day, when I hear, or when I'm part of a scene that's like that, it takes me back to that. But I also, that magic, it never goes away. It hasn't dissipated at all these years get the same joy from that.
You are a huge music fan in general, you know, beyond bluegrass and country music. What did it look like for you when you started to develop your own taste in music, like independently from your parents? I'm thinking like non-country, non-bluegrass, like maybe like the sounds of the day, like what was impacting you. And I was trying to do the math and I thought maybe like mid-70s or 80s where there was like a lot of wild stuff that was popular at the time, like thanks to FM radio getting popular. But you know, what did that look like for you to find your own musical taste?
I started discovering jazz like in the late 70s because of bluegrass, because of things that Tony Rice and David Grisman were recording, mostly because the bass players that they would have on their records, I'd be like, who's this? And then I'd try to check out those people.
So cool.
And then I would, somewhere along the line, I got turned on to Ron Carter and started listening to Jim Hall and Ron Carter early on, and finding my own way. And then there was a lot of pop music. And then, of course, I had other siblings, and so that their music was also encouraged in our house. And it was so my, you know, one of my brothers was listening to, Southern rock or more like, you know, just rock of the 70s and pop music. Another brother was into classical music. And so there was, all that stuff was already there. And I had already picked out things that I really liked, from all of those genres. And it was an easy passage because again, you know, my folks just like, I never thought about it as being sort of, oh, now I'm like liking something different. It was just, I was just adding to what I already really loved. And I didn't think about it in any other way, just like how I thought about how what I was hearing then and what I was being influenced by, how that could enhance what I was doing as a bluegrass musician. You know, how can I bring that in to, because I really got into, you know, by the early 80s, like I was into the Roaches, and I don't know if you even know who I'm talking about, but
I go down to
hell. Yes. And Joe Jackson, and the stuff that he particularly did, like Stepping Out and that stuff that he did in the early 80s. Those were like, I started thinking, I was listening to the lyric mostly, and I was listening to what they were writing about, and I could relate to them much more than I could actually relate to any bluegrass songs in terms of lyric, because with a few exceptions and song, you know, because a lot of those songs were written by men, and they were about things that even then felt like they were like 100 years old, you know, just talking about being in a cabin in Caroline, you know. It's like, I didn't know what that felt like. You know, I I grew up in a rural setting, but it wasn't a cabin in Caroline. So I just like, I loved the sound of it, but I couldn't grab hold of those lyrics. And but there were, there were a few also some women writers who were coming onto the scene in the early 80s, like Claire Lynch and folks mm-hmm. like that, who were writing stuff that was like, oh, yeah, like I can relate to this, you know, this is coming from somewhere. But then also the Roaches were like, that was the best thing in the world. I mean, they were talking about being riding a subway train and how you just feel like you can't get out of anyone's way, you know, and all the how all the uncomfortableness of being a woman out in trying to make your way through New York City. I mean, it was just I was drawn to that and all of those doors of hearing different music other than bluegrass. And the reasons why I was drawn to that, it didn't take me away from bluegrass. It just made me go, how can I bring that into me as a bluegrass player? And you mm-hmm. have to also remember that me as a bluegrass player then, you know, there weren't nearly as many women that I was looking at who was doing what I was doing. There were some, and they were amazing and opened all the doors that I was about to walk through. But there weren't very many people that looked like I did and who were playing what I was playing and who were aspiring to do the things that I was starting to have in my head.
So from what I understand, like, you were not treated any differently by your parents because you were a girl wanting to play bass. But like, as you ventured out in the world, the difference became like pretty apparent to you, as you were saying. So like, what did that evolution look like from not being aware that there was a difference to being like a major role model for other women players? Like, what was the hardest part to grasp for you? And how did you face the struggle?
Well, I think that the hardest part was, you know, just realizing that that you couldn't just do, I couldn't just try to be as good as possible. I had to either, you know, try to be better than I thought I could ever be. Like, I think there was a moment when I thought, I can't be good enough to get, you know, rise above this barrier. And that was a bit scary. But it also, there were a few women by the time I was in my 20s and stuff, there were definitely a few women I'd start to know and could talk to, and who, like Lynn Morris, you know, and who was just a little bit ahead of me, and already starting to think about having her own band. And so that was like, and it was, I was able to, you know, just listen and sort of learn from her, listen to her stories and just try to imagine what it would be like to make the transition. I don't know. I feel like I've kind of rambled from your actual question.
Well, the other interesting side of that is, like, you have been lauded with numerous impressive awards, including winning IBMA's Bass Player of the Year, which I think you won 100 times. Is it 100?
No, 101 times.
101 times in a row. But you were the first woman to win that. And then you, along with Allison Brown, Sierra Hull, Becky Buller, Molly Tuttle, you're called the first ladies of bluegrass. So they've all won. They were the first women to win IBMA blank player of the year for their instruments. So you're a role model. Now you're a role model. How do you feel about being a role model in this way for young players, not just women, to look up to? Like, do you feel a lot of pressure? Is it easy? Do you feel nothing?
Oh, no, it feels so good. And it is pressure. And it's definitely not C, which is no pressure, like, or feel nothing. Like, it is so meaningful to me. I still have, you know, every time we play out, I have almost every time I can actually say, I have someone come up to me and say, you know, you're the reason that I started to play bass. And many of them are women, but not all of them, but many of them are women who are older than me, which I didn't think was possible, that there was anyone older than me. But they're older than me, and I feel like there were, I've had some women tell me that you know, for them, their options were fewer when they were coming up. And by the time that those options became more real for them, that's when I was doing something and they saw something in me playing, and just, it was relatable, and they just went after it. And I can't tell you how that makes me feel, because it's powerful. I've had those moments myself with other people, you know, and just like I mentioned, Lynn Morris. I mean, her starting her own band in a time when very few other women had done that from that position, made me think, okay, so this might be a thing. Like, maybe one can do this. And I didn't do it for many years but that seed was planted with me because of her. And so I know what that means, and I know how powerful and life-changing it can be to just watch someone's, you know, see someone's story and learn about it, and then have it be affect you, and have that be a positive effect. I mean, there's just no greater gift to feel like you're out there giving. I mean, I love play music. I love play music for people. I love traveling. I love so many aspects about this life. But all of that, then if you think you get to do all of those things and then yet at the same time, you're not just giving like one evening's worth of like hopefully a good time, and they're getting to hear great music and they get out and they maybe escape their own life for a minute, but maybe you're also like giving them something that they are going to then hopefully get joy from for a long, long time. You know, it's really powerful.
Yeah. Yes. And you're also like being a woman on stage playing an upright bass when you did is like a statement, you know, like being, you know, like Rhiannon Giddens, being a Black banjo player is like making a statement, you know? So there's also that weight to it.
Yes.
Of, you know, your existence is a statement.
Yes.
You know, it is powerful. Yeah.
It is. And it's a gift to get to have a way to reach people. That's a gift. I mean, it's a gift to get to go play for people. It's a gift to make an album and have that actually reach the world. So many artists who are so good never get that opportunity for various reasons, you know. They don't, you know, they're not heard. And I think that's the saddest thing ever, is when a really great artist doesn't get heard.
Hey friends, you probably know that here at Basic Folk, we are not only podcasters and music fans, but we are also feminists. Folk music feminist Lizzie No is here with an important ask.
Hell yeah, Cindy. Okay, so we can all agree that abortion is healthcare, but if you live in the state of Tennessee, you will need to travel over state lines in order to access that healthcare. It's the worst. I work with an organization called Abortion Care Tennessee, and we are currently raising money so that we can make sure Tennesseans have access to reproductive health care in spite of our state's bullshit abortion ban.
There's no better time than right now to fund abortion, especially since the National Network of Abortion Funds is doubling donations between now and May 31st. Just go to abortioncaretn.org and click on the donate button. Then choose the option that says donate for Fundathon.
Thanks for joining the fight for reproductive justice. Abortion forever, no matter what.
No matter what. You and your husband, Ben Surratt, is that how you say his name?
Surratt.
Surratt, moved to Nashville. What year did you move to Nashville?
We moved here in May of 1990.
Oh, all right. So you moved 1990. You started getting calls to play. Eventually, you ended up playing with Claire Lynch and building more and more accolades. Something interesting about Nashville that you point out, and wanted to hear more about this. It's a great place to be centralized in, but it is not a great place to play.
Did I say that?
Yes. Did you mean it?
So I think I did. I did say that, but I said that a long time ago because it has changed now. The city has changed so much since when we first moved here. When I first moved here, one of the only really great venues to play would have been the Station Inn. There was a place called, the Bluegrass Inn. I think I got that right. Down, off of Broadway, and it was still here when I first moved, but it was. In just a few years, it closed down, there just wasn't quite the. It was an early scene. It was on the verge of opening up, but now there's so many great like neighborhood bars and places to play that just did not exist back then, and the scene like. We've just had this influx of all these musicians over the last couple of decades, really. And particularly in the last decade, I mean, just every day there's these great young and not so young musicians coming to town. Many of them fall under a category of like bluegrass, old time, Americana, singer, songwriter, all, everything, in between. And again, there's always been a stream of musicians coming to town, but it has just tripled in these most recent years. And of course, and as a result, there's just these great neighborhoods created with these bars that are opening up their doors to having, open mic nights and residencies and series and places for opportunities for people to play. There's a great, fiddle shop in town that has concerts. There's Station Inn, of course, is still there. A lot of bluegrass is being featured on the Grand Ole Opry these days, a lot more than used to be. I'm sure I'm forgetting like some really great thing, but there, yeah. So it's actually a really pretty great place to get work, but it's not the kind of work that. Of course, the Ryman also has a bluegrass series every summer. To clarify, it's not all like life-sustaining work. In other words, you're going to need to go out somewhere else and work because you can't play all of these places every week and all that. Mm-hmm. But and make enough money to live on. So touring is going to enter into it, or session work, or songwriting, or some aspect like that. But you can be out on the road and tour a lot, and then you come home and you could fill up your calendar working in town if you wanted to do that instead of just staying home and waiting till you go back out again. So I think those opportunities are here.
Yeah, just it's cool to hear the inside scoop from someone who's seen it, what it's like to actually live and work as a musician in Nashville. Okay, can we say that you, Missy Raines, are maybe more liberal than some others who live in the state of Tennessee?
Yes.
Okay.
We can say it loud and clear, baby.
All right, great. So over the years, how have you coped with being in a more conservative state?
Well, I can tell you that when I first moved here, it was still a conservative state. And I noticed it, but things were different. The climate was different. We all coexisted just fine. We had a Democratic governor, but Tennessee is a red state. And honestly, they got stuff done, and it just felt like it was the way I had grown up, that, people coexist with different ideals. and manage every now and then to get something done. That has changed. And so the climate here is not the same. And it doesn't feel, it is troublesome for me as a liberal, as a very liberal Democrat, to be in a place that feels like that coexistence doesn't exist anymore, and that there are definitely, you know, laws that are being created to, you know, further marginalize, you know, a lot of people, and just creating an environment that doesn't feel safe, and I don't like it, and I don't like what's happening here.
Do you ever think about leaving?
Yes. But I
come to Maine.
I would
come on.
You know what? I love Maine so much, and that is one of the places that I would actually think about. But you know, I think that one day I will be moving back to my husband's from Virginia, from the Shenandoah Valley, and all of his brothers and sisters are there, and it's very close to where my family is. So one day we'll move back there. But I'm not ready to leave Nashville. I have so many great friends here, and there are so many great things about this town and about the state. I also think about when I'm really angry and when I really think about leaving. I think about something that I read, that Brandi Carlile wrote on social media. You know, it was in reaction to one of the more dramatic and horrific trans laws that have been tried to be put through with the Tennessee Senate. And a lot of her fans were reaching out to her saying, you know, you shouldn't play in Nashville. Like, don't come to Tennessee. You shouldn't play. You should ban playing in Tennessee because of this. And I was very curious to see what her response was. And her response was basically, it was just typical, you know, Brandi Carlile, just like amazing. And she said, basically what she was saying was, I won't quote her verbatim because I can't remember, but I do remember that the gist of it was, you know, that's banning or like not coming is not the answer, because that then further separates the people who actually are there, who want and need this message, like need to feel connected with a part of the society that is, you know, supportive, and that would create a even further separation with those people who maybe can't leave the state, who can't get out. Yeah. And so she's like, I'm not going to abandon the whole rest of the people that are there just because of these things that are happening. In fact, it makes me want to come there more and be supportive of who is there and show them that we are together. And so I took that to heart. I still do every day when I get, you know, frustrated and angered by the politics that I see. And then I realize, you know, it's like, we need to go down to the state capitol and be a protester and just be part of it, and try to show support, not leave. Just try to, you know, what would Brandi do? So it's like I'm just trying to be a better person because of her, and not always succeeding. But I mean, I think that's a powerful message. I'm glad you ask, and it's difficult to say because, you know, it's always hard. I've been told many times, you know, shut up and just play music. Like I've been told as an artist, because I can tend to be a little vocal about this stuff, and you know, they don't. Some people don't want to hear about my politics, but it's who I am.
Is it all right if we talk about Rick?
My brother?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So your brother Rick, he died in 1994 from AIDS, 39 years old. You, your husband, and your mom were his caretakers. You brought him to Tennessee from LA. And this was a time when people were not living with HIV and AIDS. They were dying. I heard you speak about how difficult it was to talk about what was happening to Rick. Like, you wanted to protect him and not engage in like nasty rhetoric. How did taking care of Rick empower you to the cause versus like wanting to protect him and yourself against like quote unquote what other people thought? And like, how has that evolved for you?
Well, I suppose the most important way that it's evolved for me is that at the end of the day, what I most wanted was to help other people who were going through the same thing, and try to be a conduit to people feeling comfortable to talk about stuff and to be open in settings that might have been typically not, they might have been just fine, but there was a question whether or not it would be okay for you to talk about it. So my idea of that would be to, I might say things in conversation here and there. For a long time, I would regularly wear, the red ribbon pin in places where I thought either they won't know what it is or they will, and it might spark a conversation that they might not have had otherwise. So I really wanted to, having gone through that whole experience, I just wanted to make it better for somebody else than it was for me. And for me, because we were going through it as it happened, you know, and as you say, like at the time, when I knew my brother was positive, tested HIV positive by 1985, because that was when his partner died of HIV. And his partner died very quickly, like within a couple of weeks, went from being perfectly well and healthy to being gone. And so at that point, we knew that he would have been exposed. And so that moment was, although horrible, it was a gift, because we looked at each other and said, you know, okay, no opportunities missed going forward. Like, and I knew that at that moment, unless they found a cure, he was not going to grow to be an old man. And he knew it too. So I knew that there wasn't anything I was going to miss. And he was living in California. I was living in Virginia at the time. We'd always been close, but we were 8 years apart. So, but that meant when he called at 2 a.m, you know, I might say, I'll call you tomorrow, I'd pick up the phone and we'd talk for however long we needed to talk. You know, times that I got to go to LA and spend with him, I took those times. And so as a result, I mean, he lived for like another 9 years. So it was great because I didn't miss anything. And, and that made me also think that that's how we should live every day with everybody that matters. And if we did, we wouldn't miss anything, but it's hard to do that. It's unrealistic to think you can do that every day with everyone that matters to you. But I do see that as that was a gift. But I think that what I learned from all of that was that there were a lot of people who I probably misjudged, thinking that they wouldn't have understood, but would have. And later talking to them, you know, maybe years and so into the future, you realize that, I was just as capable of misjudging situations as maybe they were. And so you learn that. And I mean, gosh, everything is clear with hindsight.
Yeah. Sorry that it's just I feel like we could do a whole other interview just on this particular topic, and maybe we will one day. I think about this situation a lot because it's, you know, in 2024, people can get a shot once a month, and they're around, you know, and it's a very like complicated, complex topic. And thank you for expanding on it and talking about it, because I think it is easy to forget that particular time period if it didn't personally touch you and personally affect it. So thank you for talking about it.
Thank you for asking.
Okay, let's talk about Embracing Bluegrass once again on this new album, Highlander. This album seems like it continues where Royal Traveler, which was your last record, where that left off. From your perspective, how do you feel like you fit into like the makeup of bluegrass? And what has that looked like throughout your career?
You know, it's how do I fit into the makeup of bluegrass? That's a great question. And that's what, yeah, you sort of hit it on the nail on the head, because that's kind of what Highlander is all about. It's me trying to figure that out. I thought I'd already figured that out. And Royal Traveler was kind of that time that I spent exploring a lot of different roads for me, and being produced by Alison Brown on that record as well. She really pushed me in a number of ways, and meaning she just challenged me, and she said, no, you go for this, go for that. And it was really powerful. And I think that when that record was done and I was really thinking about what it was that I wanted to do next, and I realized that what I'd been wanting to do for a long time was to have a bluegrass band, my own bluegrass band. Like, I'd played in so many other bluegrass bands all my life, but I'd never had one of my own. And I wanted that. And I knew I wanted it several years ago, and started thinking about this record then. But yeah, I had to think about how that was going to be for me, because I didn't want it to sound like anyone else's record and anyone else's kind of bluegrass. And so, yeah, I had to figure that out of what it was I needed to say, how to use my voice, just in not just my singing voice, but how to speak with the songs I chose or the songs I wrote, and how that all came together. So, yeah, it was, and so many things fell in place in terms of the musicians that I was able to like pull together for this project and for this band. And so that helped so much, because I knew I needed musicians who understood the vocabulary, and that we were all speaking the same language. And I found those people. And then once that was there, it just took me a lot of soul searching, a lot of hearing us try to play different songs and how that sounded. Like listening back to rehearsal tapes and thinking, yeah, this is what I want. Or maybe, no, this just doesn't fit us, or any of those choices, all in between. And I still feel like I'm figuring all of that out, but I have a much clearer idea now what it is that is my voice, and how I fit into bluegrass. And gosh, it's taken a long time, for me to do that. But honestly, I never really tried before. So I guess you can't really figure it out until you actually like try.
Oh my gosh, I have like 500 questions left, but we don't have that much. You know, I'm not going to ask all 500 of them. But Alison Brown produced this record. What does your connection to Alison look like? you both came up at the same time in bluegrass. I feel like you're like maybe the same age, like a maybe like 6 months apart or something like that. What has it been like to have someone like Allison to like grow up with in music and in bluegrass?
That connection, our connection is so special in many ways for many reasons, but a lot because of, you know, yes, we are the same age, except that as she will definitely point out, I am about 4 months older, we always we text each other on our birthdays for sure, and then of course she always texts me on my birthday to say that the next 4 months are the best months of her life, and and so it goes on like that. But truly, you know, having someone that you can relate to, who has seen what you've seen, who's been through the same things that you, is really special. But what I also love about it is that although we have seen so many of the same things, we actually do come from very, very different kind of backgrounds and very different parts of the country. And so that creates also this nice diversity within us, which has opened up my eyes to so many things. And I think that I've introduced her to a few things as well, to in terms of like my heritage and all of that. And so
I was going to ask if she gets the West Virginia thing.
Well, I think she does now.
Yeah, after she made this record with you. Yeah.
I mean, I truly think that the whole mid-Atlantic thing that I kept saying throughout the whole thing, because I said, like, this is really about growing up on the East Coast, and this is what bluegrass was there. And I think she definitely got a real glimpse of what that was like. And having folks like Danny Paisley on it and that, and Dudley Connell and those folks who are from that area. And so, yeah, she does now. And, you know, of course, you know, she comes from like a completely different background, went to Harvard, you know, did all these things, grew up in California. So I love the diversity that our friendship has. But yet at the end of the day, man, can we totally just vibe out on like, we get it from the experience that we've had playing in this business as women, and at a time, you know, back when we can remember when we didn't even know, like you talked about the first ladies of bluegrass, and when we didn't even know like three other women who were band leaders.
Wow.
And could sit in the same room with like three or four other women that were doing exactly what we were trying to do. And so being with somebody like that, it really means a lot.
Okay. Maybe two more questions and then the lightning round. Are you okay on time?
I'm fine. I could talk all day.
Okay, okay, great. We are recording this, I think, maybe like when was the Super Bowl? A couple weeks ago? One or 2 weeks ago?
Yeah.
Okay, so Beyonce has put out a couple of her country songs, which makes me think about Beyonce's putting out a country album. Lainey Wilson won Best Country Artist of the Year for the Grammys this year. I don't know if you know what she sounds like.
I don't. I know the name, okay. But
do you know like modern commercial country singing, like very y'all kind of singing?
Okay.
Beyonce is not singing like that.
yeah.
My friend and Basic Folk podcast co-host Lizzie No put a record out this year that has country songs on it. She is not singing like y'all, but they're country songs. You are someone who you say, I don't have a bluegrass voice, but you make bluegrass music. The question that I wanted to formulate has not really grasped. I don't really have the the exact wording for it, but can we talk about what it's like to be a vocalist where you don't feel like you're expressing the genre that you're singing, but you're still doing it anyway, and you're like, this is bluegrass music, no matter what. Like Beyonce saying, this is country music, no matter what.
Yeah, I think that that holds weight when the intention of the song carries it. When the intention of the song comes from a place that is, like, for in my case, like, is that is bluegrass to you, to me. And when I am, I choose what I choose to sing, you know, I spend a lot of time deciding what it is that I'm going to sing or write and so once I make that decision and I can sing it, I spend a lot of time making sure that when I sing it, I feel it makes me feel a certain way. And if it makes me feel a certain way, then I'm good, because I know that is the essence of what bluegrass is, because it's my intention. And my intention is my intention is not to try to convince you that it's bluegrass. It's my intention is I'm just trying to say, I am saying this in my bluegrass language. And so it doesn't, you know, at the end of the day, I have long stopped caring whether or not somebody else thinks it's bluegrass. You know, they're going to make their own decision on that. I know it is, because I know where it's coming from inside of me.
Standing ovation. I can't stand up or my microphone will fall over, but amazing answer. I'm taking that one to the bank, Missy.
I'm so excited.
We're going to make so much money. Okay. One last question, not about music. I read that you are an animal lover and wanted to hear more about your relationship to animals over your life.
Yeah, I am.
sounds exhausting.
When it comes to animals, I am a bit exhausting. I won't lie, because I have cats. I don't have dogs just because I can't travel with them and be fair. And it's hard enough with cats, and I have cat sitters and all that. I love animals so much. I believe that we were put here to do two things. I do believe we were put here to make things better for the world. And in that regard, I see one of those ways is to create art. But the other thing that I think that we were put here to do is to be caretakers for those who can't take care of themselves, and to take care of things like animals that we've domesticated, and to protect the ones that we haven't domesticated. And so, yeah, that whole animal thing is like, it's a pretty big deal for me. I've also, you know, have lots of history of just, I've made a few changes for people in their lives about how they take care of their own animals by just speaking up a little bit, getting involved, maybe some places where I shouldn't have, but actually I should have, because I feel like that's what we're supposed to do. But yeah, personally, like right now I have two cats and I can't believe they're not in here right now, but
Well, my dog has entered the chat. I don't know if you can see her.
Oh,
Puddles, come here.
Oh, Look
Cuddles at that, has entered the chat.
That baby. See, you heard me talking about animals. Oh my gosh. What a baby.
Yeah. Yeah. She's a big.
Yeah.
She's a humongous dog. But I was wondering if we could do the lightning round, because I have to go feed. The dog's name is Puddles. I have to go feed Puddles, but I want to do the lightning round.
Okay. What is are you ready? What is the lightning round?
Well, it's like what we've been doing, me asking you questions about you, except you answer faster.
Okay.
And shorter.
Okay.
Okay. Here we go. Missy Rains, the lightning round. Where is the best place to sit at the music festival?
In the front row.
Center? Front row center?
Oh, front row center, absolutely.
What is your favorite West Virginia treat?
Italian food. And that sounds like it's not connected, but it actually is. Because West Virginia, especially the part of West Virginia I'm from, is full of Italian immigrants, and it's some of the best Italian food I've ever had.
Oh, hot tip. All right. Okay, Missy, how many dogs are you getting to pet per day? How many dogs are you petting per day?
Like none.
No.
I know. It's very sad. It's very sad.
What is your favorite plant to grow?
Well, orchids.
Okay. All right. That sounds difficult, right? Ice cubes and gloves and stuff. And
Cubes. And that's all I do. Ice cubes.
Okay. How do you clean your base and how often?
I don't and never.
Okay. This one is an important one. Who is your fashion icon?
I just think Marty Stewart always looks really great. But in terms of, I guess you're probably thinking, let me see. Oh, gosh. It's so terrible. I'm so bad at this.
Marty Stewart is an extremely acceptable answer. Yeah. Anyone that dresses to match their instrument?
I just impressive. The man has incredible style, and there's something, there's a way he carries himself and he dresses to match it. It works.
This is the last question. Where is your dream vacation?
Oh, the beach. But not a Caribbean beach, like a beach in Maine.
A beach in Maine.
Yes.
That's great. Well, great. I'll see you at the beach. This has been the most fun interview I've done in a really long time. Thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure. I've had a really great time.
This episode of Basic Folk was produced by CJ Nungesser. Our music composed by Alex Stanton. Basic Folk is on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network. You can find all of our episodes at thebluegrasssituation.com. You can check us out on folkalley.com or Folk Alley's mobile app. You can search for us in the SiriusXM mobile app under Basic Folk. You can find us wherever you get podcasts, or you can check us out at basicfolk.com. If you enjoyed this episode, I invite you to share it with a friend. Maybe your one friend that is from West Virginia and has so many West Virginia things around their house. Because isn't that state so good at marketing itself? And they have really glommed on to like bougie, indie craft world with their beautiful merchandise. I wish I had some myself, but I don't. I guess I could fix that. But anyways, you should share this with your West Virginia friend that is super duper into West Virginia, because I think people from West Virginia like to know about other people from West Virginia, and this is a fantastic opportunity. Send it to your West Virginia friend. Okay, thanks for listening all the way to the end. We'll talk to you next time. Bye.